Watch this. No way!
Hello and welcome back to the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast. I am Tom Mills and today I'm joined by Sam Williams.
Hello.
Cal Wing.
Hello.
And Sir Bruce Fitzpatrick.
Howdy.
How are we doing, guys?
Yeah, very well, thank you. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you. Very good. Feel like I've played a lot of golf recently. Feels like there's just no relent on the level of competitive golf that's been played.
Such a first world problem, isn't it?
Must be so hard for you.
I know, exactly. I wasn't looking for sympathy.
What golf have you been playing then?
Well, we had a nice little trip, didn't we, down at the bar. Yeah, we had a nice little trip down the Berkshire, and we did obviously played Clee Hill the other week. We've had a bit of members and guest action at our home club, and obviously before that we had our little trip up to the northwest with Royal Liverpool and Hoylake, which is on a YouTube channel very near you right this minute. So, definitely signpost our listeners at that. So that's been good. Cal, you particularly like the fire. You liked the violins, didn't you, Cal, particularly?
It was very dramatic. It was very Britain's Got Talent, I thought. It was quite emotional.
I always feel like if you're going to do a podcast teaser, you need to get Vanessa May in the background.
Well, to be honest, after the violins, I was expecting old Piers to be the narrator. Piers Morgan, what was that?
Pitched battle out of a pot bunker or something and...
Exactly.
Yeah. All sorts of drama there.
So, am I taking that as constructive criticism that perhaps toned down the?
No, to be fair, I actually really liked
of it all.
I thought it was quite amusing. No, in a good way.
Very intense. Fun. I had to go and sit in a quiet room after watching it. It's very intense stuff. So,
for those of you who haven't found our YouTube channel yet, you can find us on Cookie Jar Golf on YouTube. We have just released our third episode of Story of a Golf Club, which was Royal Liverpool, Hoylake, which was very good fun. We were hosted up there by the wonderful Sam Cooper, who looked after us, and we got to do some pretty cool stuff. I mean, there's not many people that get to get their hands on Tiger's 2-iron and John Ball's open medals and things like that. And you can see it all on the YouTube, but it was very, very good day, thoroughly enjoyable. And we've got something a little bit different coming in the coming weeks. That we're going to try and get out to you. So keep your eyes peeled for that one. Pushing it forward today, we're going to talk a little bit about... We've had a little bit of a layoff, haven't we, chaps, that we need to address?
Well, the Bobby Jones thing was nice to do, wasn't it? Because of East Lake. And I don't know about you boys, but I can't really get excited about watching DJ walk it in with a 6-shot lead or whatever he had for a $15 million check. So
no,
it feels like a little bit of, you know, in the Tour de France, they've got that sort of 5 miler they do on the last day, which is just a bit of a victory lap through the French streets of Paris. Kind of felt a little bit like that, the Tour Championship this year. So I'm glad we did the Bobby Jones thing because it was the right time to release that with obviously 90 years and Eastlake being a very special place for him. So we had that in the chamber for a while and kind of now heading into a bit of major golf and all sorts of stuff happening, just feels like the right time to get the boys back together.
Definitely. US Open week. Big week ahead.
Honourable mentions to a few amateur events as well that have been and gone. The amateur at Royal Birkdale on the bank holiday weekend in August was won by Joe Long. Battle of the Two Joes. Did anyone catch any of the highlights of that?
I saw it all on Twitter. So that R&A did quite a good thing on Twitter. They were sort of posting video clips on each green so you could kind of stay abreast. I think I can't remember exactly what else was going on that weekend, but I couldn't help
the women's amateur actually. The women's amateur
was, that right?
Was on just down the road.
Oh, over at West Lancs. It would be nice to see those sorts of events on TV because it's match play golf and, you know, it's an event with equal footing as the US Am, which obviously was played out in the States and you could watch and you couldn't see any of the British Am, which I thought was a shame, particularly around a great place like Birkdale. So,
but they did have, on the R&A website, there is quite an extensive sort of 10-minute highlight reel that you can see of the final, which is pretty good. I mean, by all accounts, Joe Long has got the ability to just pour in a putt from absolutely everywhere. It was like, yeah, it was like watching Yoda putt. It was ridiculous. So I saw the
final round highlight, or that final highlights of the final, and it was absolutely canning it from everywhere. And it was naturally, you sort of have to check out what putter he's using just in case it might benefit.
That's a neat segue, Cal. Where are we? Because where are we on the flat stick? So last time we hooked up, you were fashioning another. I think you were shortening the one you'd already shortened. You had another one in the bag.
Yeah, I tried that.
Are you going in with one of these ERGs or whatever they're called? Yeah.
Even roll. Yeah, no, it's... Yeah, that was all credit to a few guys at the club, including Bruce's brother, who had gone in, and I sort of eyed them up. And yeah, if something looks good, it won't take me long to ask a few more questions. So went and tried one and came down to two models, had to step away, sleep on it, went back the next day, purchased it, and seems to be going all right. I mean, yes, Saturday was his first outing. But, you know, it's also a big week for all of us. You know, I'm sure we're all playing the club championship as well. So just trying to find anything.
You putted well on Sunday, actually. You putted well yesterday. Actually, it's worth a shout out because our listeners ought to know that Cal and his partner, Simon, picked up the gross prize in our Sunday members guest edition. But was so hungover.
That's the big one, Cal. That's the big one.
That's the big
good
one,
to get it. Good to get that one in before the club championship, mate.
Yeah, before I was rudely interrupted by Sam there. Yeah, so hungover that you decided to go home and actually, you know, catch up on some sleep. And when the award was made on the first tee box, there was just a very eerie sort of silence. Cal Wing? Anyone seen Cal?
Nice tumbleweed. But it's funny to be honest.
He was oiling his putter at home in the garage.
It's my guest, Simon, and I, many of you will know, Simon Haynes is Twitter fanatic, bit of a legend. We looked at the leaderboard, and to be fair, Sunday was a Stableford, and we saw people in slightly higher than us, or more points on the leaderboard, and we didn't really think anything of it. So we thought, because there was a gross score for the Saturday as well, so because that was the medal day, so that made sense. But anyway, yeah, delighted to hear about first place and pro shop voucher and everything else. So probably put that towards another putter. So that'll be good.
It was like Battle of the Historians at Blackwell on Saturday, because while Cal had Simon Haynes, Sam's guest was James Woods, the historian out of Birkdale. So that was quite interesting.
AKA Stymie69, arguably the greatest Twitter handle in the history of golf. So no, good. And I mean, it was a subtle education in drinking and historical facts of the game. So very enjoyable.
It was quite interesting to walk around watching Sam be corrected on nearly every fact that he pulled out by an actual golf historian. So that was something to behold. I don't usually get the opportunity to correct him.
Turns out TPC Sawgrass wasn't designed by old Tom Morris, which interesting fact that. So every day's really? A school day, isn't it?
Because that was that was Darwin's favourite, wasn't it?
TPC. Oh, well, yeah.
He's written a lot about Sawgrass.
Can we move on to some more public interest stories, though, beyond obviously Cal's foursomes, mems and guests?
Well, it's not only the men's am, we had the women's am, won by probably the most American sounding German I've ever heard in my life.
Aline Krauter. Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure she grew up or she went to high school in Florida. I mean, she plays at Stanford.
You could tell she's lived her entire life there.
I mean, is that really? I mean, does her nationality matter all that much?
No, but like, you know, when someone wins an award and you see their flag, you're like, okay, I'm going to, that's the accent I'm going to hear.
You're kind of visualizing it.
Yeah. You know, like you have that moment when people talk where it takes you like sort of, you haven't got a clue what they're saying, and it takes you sort of 2 seconds to tune in to their accent, and then you can understand everything. Well, I was
you're
prepared
for
a German accent, yeah, and I just didn't get it, and I was confused for quite some time. But I'm easily confused, so that's. But that's at West Lancs. West Lancs was looking good, as always.
Looked like a very close encounter. I think she won on the 18th hole, one up after going down early.
kind of a shame when you think about COVID there, though, because that's a great advert for golf on the Northwest Coast. And having those two events there running side by side, you could have easily kind of hopped between the two and enjoyed quite the spectacle. So it is a shame. I know from others that, you know, it was really strict in terms of attendance, which I suppose you can understand. But, you know, if you let spectators into the amateur, you're unlikely to get crowds of 50,000 people. So was there scope to maybe, you know, throw some tickets up and kind of let, even maybe if it's some juniors with their parents, take them around? I don't know, but it would have been just feels like a little bit of a missed opportunity there. And obviously that's the world we're all living in right now. So,
and of course, amateur wise, we've got the Varsity match that happened, which our boy Bruce did some caddying. So you're in a great position to talk us through that one, Brucey.
Yeah, no, I did. I caddied for my younger brother who was representing Oxford. And it was a close encounter. It was brilliant that it went ahead at all, because it was originally scheduled for March at the Honourable Company of Edinburgh Golfers. But they did a fantastic job rearranging the match for August, allowing quite a few people who wouldn't have otherwise got their blues to win their blues. Cambridge were ahead 3-2 after the foursomes on the Sunday, but then a huge sort of Monday turnaround in Oxford's favour. They won the singles 8.5 to 1.5, I believe, and ended up being quite a one-sided affair, all things considered. But it was great fun to watch. Very limited spectators, but still, you could see how much it meant to both teams, and played in the right spirit of the game, played pretty quickly, and just a lot of fun. Obviously, I am.
How was the course playing?
The course was in fantastic condition, but the rough was so brutal. I mean, Cal, you played there earlier in the summer, didn't you? And as you said, like, if you miss the fairway by 5 yards, it's a lost ball.
I think I was sort of early July, and it wasn't far off waist high, I'd say, in places. It was brutal, but to be fair, it was just looking awesome. Contrast between fairways and the rough was just magnificent. So they probably trimmed it down slightly for you guys, but it's probably still comfortably knee high at least.
It was just really dense at the bottom as well. I mean, you could literally be, 1 yard into that stuff and you weren't going to find your ball. Even with a few families walking around, sort of going ahead to spot balls and things. I mean, there were quite a few occasions where people didn't find the ball. But overall, the standard golf was pretty high. I mean, Virginia Carter, who's going out on, I believe she's going to try and qualify for the LPGA Tour next year. She was representing the Cambridge team, her Oxford oppo Rory Giddens had a very, very close encounter, very high scoring, or very low scoring match, I should say, high quality golf. And it was great fun, glorious weather, not much wind, couldn't really have asked for much more, to be honest.
So just thinking in terms of news that's been going on then, so what have we missed since we were all last on the pod? I guess some fairly gratuitous checks being handed out at the Tour Championship last week or 2 weeks ago.
Just the 15 mil, was it, in the end?
But it wasn't even that so much, was it? Like, what, you know, what were, like, 30th place was walking home with a six-figure sum, weren't they, or something?
That was scary. Yeah,
400k for finishing last in the playoff.
Just bonuses getting thrown out everywhere, and it was... in contrast to a lot of other things, it just seems like excessive.
But the FedEx money extends from the top to the bottom. So they actually, if you were on the PGA Tour that year, you doesn't matter what stage of it you fell out of it, you got some FedEx money at the end. And if you finished in 125 to 150th spot, which is not making any of the playoffs whatsoever, you still got dropped 70k. FedEx for not getting, for not doing anything. Like, oh yeah, you've missed, you're not good enough to do this. Here's 70k.
So for those who, that's crazy, for those who didn't make the Wyndham rewards, then it was another bonus.
I'm just thinking out loud here. If you're on like sort of marketing sort of like team at FedEx, it can't be a sensible spend of money. It must cost them absurd amounts of cash. I mean, like, let's face it, if you're going to post something, you're going to post something with someone. I'm not sure people are going to post it with FedEx because they sponsor a golf tournament. I might be wrong. I might be wide of the mark. I kind of get it on Pepsi and Coca-Cola or whatever, or Mackey D's and Burger King. But that's just a simply incredible amount of money for a company that posts stuff. I mean,
I've got a feel. So they'll be like majority sponsor. Then there'll be, there's all those other names behind it as well. Obviously, Coca-Cola are still very much synonymous with Atlanta and the course itself, Eastlake, obviously the founders being based there, but and then obviously just the TV deals and everything else. I mean, obviously it's adverts sort of every 2 minutes, so
it's kind of rolling in. It's a poor viewing experience, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a great set of commercials with it. I mean, there's only a little bit of golf just chucked in between the commercials, really, and they're not too frequent. So I mean, it's predominantly adverts. And it was,
But what I would say about the whole setup that has happened this year, you know, with the playoffs and how they've done, they've narrowed it down. I mean, there were some big names that missed out on the tour finals, but the top five in the world were pretty much the top five going into the last couple of days, which is what you want to see, isn't it? You want to see a bit of a shootout. How do we feel about this sort of handicap system then? Like, I mean, let's be fair, DJ does not need a 10-shot head start. Good enough to win without it.
There must be some 10-shot head start, is it? I mean, he had a four-shot head start over Rahm. But I get what you mean, in that the 30th ranked player was even par. I think, I mean, this is only the second iteration of this sort of new format. McIlroy, I believe, when he won last year, won both the tournament and the playoffs as a whole. But, you know, I'm thinking back to a conversation we had a few weeks ago, maybe a month or so ago, in fact, actually, Sam, when, you know, you were giving me stick over Sam Snead's win record on the PGA Tour and the number of events he'd won and how he'd won the sort of four-ball, eight-man tournament, wherever it was back in the 50s. And I wonder whether Schauffele, who I think won this week, or last week, sorry, in the Tour Championship, I wonder whether that counts on his record or not, or whether it just simply goes to DJ.
He picked up the world ranking points for it, didn't he? So I think the world ranking system was reflective of the fact that he'd won the tournament, even though he obviously didn't bring in the... I mean, that's why it becomes... I don't know, it's bizarre, isn't it? Because really, DJ's the headline there. He's won the FedEx. But actually, Schauffele's won the tournament sort of discreetly. Whichever way, they all walked off into the distance with sick checks. I don't know. Remember that year Rose won it, didn't he? Rose won the FedEx, he didn't win the tournament. I think Tiger won it that year. And there's probably no right or wrong answer. I can only assume the people who've done the numbers on the handicapping, they've done it with a serious level of statistical insight that would say that's about the right balance.
But I've got my own personal idea that I feel like could enhance the experience of the playoffs. Now, this could be utter drivel, but I'm happy to be shot down.
Okay. Shotgun starts.
So this all started from the fact that probably the one before the tour finals, Webb Simpson decided not to turn up because he was already in the top 30, knew he couldn't lose that, and thought he was going to rest for Eastlake. So he didn't bother to show up for the penultimate tournament. Which got me thinking about, well, that can't be right for the sponsors and it can't be right for the viewers because they want to see the best players in the world. So my idea was that instead of doing like you play and then you get cut and then you start fresh and get cut, that it's a rolling 12-round tournament and your score gets carried through to the next tournament. So basically, you're forcing everybody to play because if you don't, you start
pretty attritional, isn't it? Jesus,
at different courses. Well,
yeah, and after the four rounds, they have a cut and they get rid of the bottom 30 or whatever, and you go take 70 through. But I mean, that sorts out the men from the boys, isn't it? 12 rounds of golf.
I just think whatever they were doing like 2 years ago, even when I think they tried this last year, but 2 years ago when Tiger won Tour Championship. And even the years before that, it seemed to work quite nicely, where this year was so boring to watch, with like DJ already killing it, already with his like 10 shot lead on most of the players. It was just dull, and especially shooting like 30 under, it was tough to tune in on the Sunday. It was just lost interest, which is a shame, because East Lake's a great track and with great history. And I don't know, I just didn't feel quite right.
I'm not sure where I stand on it, actually, because on the one hand, I think you might just struggle with any 30-man tournament to generate that much excitement. I mean, 30 people is just, that's really not many people to have on the course, is it? And maybe this year it's tough to evaluate, because the guy who went in on the lowest score, you know, on 10 under, was DJ, who was just playing the golf of his life, having, you know, he won at, was it the Travelers? And then he, you know, really, you know, was in a good position going into the PGA, which he could have won for his second major, but then he marmalized the field at the Northern Trust. And, you know, missed out narrowly to Rahm the week before. So maybe that's just the nature of the beast. When you've got someone who's in a rich vein of form and you give them, you know, a favorable starting position on top of that, I'm not sure. I don't know if it was necessarily, it's hard to compare it to 2 years ago in Tiger won, because obviously that was just a momentous occasion for golf as a whole, wasn't it? I mean, there wasn't a golf fan out there who didn't want Tiger to win and make his sort of comeback. But yeah, the last 2 years, have they been exciting? I'm not so sure.
I think the problem is that just before the Tiger one, because that was really exciting, but before that, it was really confusing to understand who was going to win the FedEx.
Yeah.
Because it was just like, oh, this person's winning a tournament, but this is how many ranking points they get, and this guy can do this if he wins. And it was just really confusing to understand who was going to win. But if you look at DJ, I mean, this is just one of those things that in the last three tournaments that he's won, which has all come in recent times, he's cumulatively 70 under par.
What I was thinking in my head is, when you look at the run he's had from, was it the Travelers where he had the new putter? I can't remember.
Yeah, he beat Brandon
Todd. From there, he has been, you know, like you say, Bruce, absolutely unstoppable. You can probably rig the system however you want to rig it, but short of handicapping him by 10 shots against the field on a lot of these tournaments, he probably would have given it a pretty good run for the win anyway. So, but he does look in form now. He seems to have gone back.
He should be in reverse. Yeah. They should take 10 shots off DJ and take 6 shots off Rahm and say, here we go, we're going to neutralize
that everybody. That sounds reasonable. We'll put that to the sponsors when you've got Joel Darman as the FedEx winner. But I mean, DJ looks insanely good, doesn't he, going into the Open? And we're going to no doubt talk about the US Open in a minute. Cal, you mentioned sponsors in the background of the FedEx, and it seems pretty topical to mention the sponsors board that was in the background at the A&A Inspiration event that obviously has just finished.
Literally the background.
About 5 yards off the back of the green on a par 5 hole, which they're playing as their 72nd golf hole.
Go long, there'll be zero consequences.
And behind that, there is a sheer drop straight into water. So the hole is designed so that you either play a control shot from 100 to 150 yards with confidence of stopping it, or you take out a long club and you have difficulty stopping it. So to incorporate some sponsor stuff behind the green, we've erected something that's about 12 feet high. So these girls are just slamming 5 woods up into the green, straight into the back, and then chipping. And that's ultimately how Miriam Lee's gone on to win the event. She's gunned it straight into the backboard. And I mean, all credit to her, she's chipped in 3 times on the final round. So you've got to hand it to her. She's played great golf. And I don't want to take away from that.
She played for the backboard.
Yeah. Look, I'm not saying it's not her fault. Those are the rules. But why the hell would the tournament organizer put it in that way? It just makes literally no sense.
It doesn't quite make sense, does it? No, to be honest, I don't think there's any more of an explanation than that. It's just very odd. It's surely when he's setting that thing up, you're looking back at the tee thinking, this could be used as a bit of a wall, bit of a rebound shot.
Well, there are a couple more threads actually to pull on as far as the ANA is concerned. And probably an even more controversial aspect was the fact that Sofia Popov was not invited, despite having won the Women's Open at Troon just a few weeks ago. We got any thoughts on that?
I think I agree with this, and I know I'm going to get shot down, but it's the same reason I agree with the Masters field being set back in April, because it's not supposed to be tournaments that were played when they were played, and the fields were set. And at the time, because of the way that the Opens were played, they shouldn't have been played in that order. So there was nothing in their sort of remit to say that the winner of the Open would go and play in the ANA. You've got a field set, you know, just because of coronavirus, you can't just change it.
More person in. Get the equivalent of Jeff Knox. Just get the equivalent of Jeff Knox to go around Mission Hills with her, or invite a couple more people. I get the whole idea about the logistics, and you know, maybe you shouldn't. In fact, I agree with you, Mills. You shouldn't be kicking out the sort of lower ranked players who just about snuck in back in March when the whole schedule was just panned. You don't necessarily have to kick them out to put Sofia Popov and other people like Daniel Berger into these events. I think, you know, they're not mutually exclusive. Why can't you just invite a few more people and have one more group at the end of the field?
Let me just jump in here though. So you're fair challenge, Mills, but just to pop you back in your box for a minute here. Andy Sullivan won a few weeks ago at Hanbury Manor, I believe, in the English Open. It was not an event. It was not a recognised event. He is now teeing it up out in Wingfoot this week. Now, Sofia Popov's won the Ladies British Open. It's a major tournament. She cannot get herself into that field on a sponsor's exemption, an exemption from the organisation.
Do you know what the European Tour did there? To make that work.
Well, to make those events happen, I'm guessing they said that gave them open qualification if they want.
So they with the UK swing, they did like a sort of UK swing sort of leaderboard for those six events. And I think the top 10 people on this leaderboard for the six events got an exemption if they weren't already exempt into the US Open, which included like Detry and Sullivan and...
Is that because, though, the US Open was supposed to be now?
Those events were never happening. They were never happening before all of this anyway. So that UK swing.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is if the US Open was supposed to happen and there were supposed to be a bunch of qualifying tournaments that were all shelved because of COVID, it's fair to give them an opportunity to whatever the situation that may be, you're given the opportunity to qualify.
But it was scheduled for June, though, wasn't it? The US Open's always
in June.
Is that
when it was?
The US Open's always in June.
So I basically have no comeback then.
Yeah.
Do you think?
I think it's more though. It's more boxed in. It's more just spirit of the game, isn't it? I mean, how can you not let a current major champion play in the field? Of course, okay, maybe it.
Yeah.
I see both arguments of the story, but it's golf. She's just won a major. Let her play.
Can I ask a question of you boys? If in 14 years' time, do you think Golf Digest will go on to write an article saying one of the all-time lightweight winners of the US Open was Andy Sullivan if he wins this week?
Yeah. That was a shocking, that was brutal, shocking wasn't it? Article, wasn't
it? That journo has been absolutely ripped to shreds. Golf Digest have lost the only slither of respect they had in the golfing community this week in one fell swoop.
Can you elaborate for our...
So the overall sentiment of the article was that they tried to document who were the all-time lightweight winners of the US Open. And in that article, front and center, it was Michael Campbell, who obviously won round Pinehurst with a famously artistic short game with a risk-free lob shot straight up his left nose. In Bruce's words, I think, you know, ultimately held off the field against a charging tiger. And I looked at the numbers. He shot 69 on the last day, and so did Woods to beat him by two shots. And then it all of a sudden slammed by this guy who, apart from winning, similar to Cal, a sort of members and guests day of maybe once or twice at his local club, doesn't seem to have had an illustrious playing career.
Not bad, though. It still went like the World Match Play at Wentworth and number of other decent events.
So yeah, yeah. No, the journalist hadn't won anything. No, obviously, you know, Mark Campbell's won.
No, sorry,
had great wins, but the journalist, you know, has obviously got zero majors under his belt. So it just felt like a bit of a swipe, if I'm honest.
I missed this. I completely missed
it. It's a pure swipe. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was a Golf Digest article on Michael Campbell.
The word was the most underwhelming. The 10 most underwhelming winners of the US Open.
But it's crazy, consider, because it is like it's a proper US Open story. I mean, actually, like 2 weeks before, he wasn't in the field. He's gone through qualifying at Walton Heath. He's won that, and then he's gone on to he's got himself into the Open off the back of that. It's a proper Francis Ouimet story.
Yeah,
like he's gone through full qualifying, got in, and plugged away, and end of the day, he shot 69 final round and won.
Yeah, I'd almost say it's one of the greatest wins, really, when you put it in that context.
It was a great win.
Well,
which segues really quite nicely onto the US Open at Wingfoot.
Mm.
What do we think? Are we thinking DJ's going to run away with it?
No.
Too obvious. Yeah, too obvious.
No. Rough.
Too obvious. It's not a thriller.
It looks brutal. It looks brutal. From what I haven't really... I'm going to start plugging into it from this evening, but... from what I've seen, snippets and green speeds and everything else, it looks like a proper test. Okay.
Here's a quiz for you. What was the winning score the last time the US Open was
5 over Jeff Ogilvy.
Yeah, Jeff Ogilvy. Jeff Ogilvy, yeah, correct.
Wasn't it? I thought Monty won that one.
Monty and Phil both
runner up.
Yeah. Monty was runner up.
2006.
Am I right? Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah. Yeah. Correct. Year after the most, was the year after the most underwhelming win. So
it was.
I'm surprised that wasn't featured on the guy's article as well. But Monty just, you know, he didn't stay loose, as he likes to say, at the top of his backswing with his 7-iron. And
so what was it? I'm going to say score. Was it something like 5 I was going to say? I guess would have been 4 over. But,
Is my mic not plugged in or something?
No, Cal just chooses what he listens to.
Yeah, no, Monty dumped it in. I think he dumped it in the deep rough.
So it was a green side.
On the green and then 3-putted for double. Phil's carved it left into the trees, gone for some heroic shot, didn't really make it through, then knocked it in the bunker for 3 because he was still somewhat stymied. I think he also made 69. Double. Did he also make double? Also, Jeff Ogilvy, I'm pretty sure he ripped his second shot off the front of the green, but then just hit this like very, very delicate spinning chip shot.
How you remember this? You're only about six years old, weren't you?
I'll put a bit more into that. So Monty was middle of the fairway on 18. There's a greenside bunker short, and the rough surrounding this greenside bunker is just brutal. Yeah, walked off with a six. As soon as it went in, it was like, even the commentators were like, oh no, because you know he's not coming out of there. And you know, like, I think, would 5, if he had made bogey, would that have got him in
to a playoff?
Yeah, so it was just, you could see the ball just get swallowed up, and it was just like, absolutely no chance. Well, I think he had no green to work with either. And
he only
just
had a 7-iron in his hand as well.
Yeah, that was it.
They reckon the rough this year is about as brutal as it gets, don't they? They reckon this is possibly the most brutal rough that they've seen a major played on in years and years and years. But they say that every year. Oh yeah, they're saying it's like wire. Like you've got zero chance in there.
With that in mind, it's clearly premium on accuracy off the tee. Doesn't feel like it's going to be a bomber's course.
Mm.
Well, it could be. That's the thing with big rough, is actually it doesn't penalize the longer hitter. If anything, it plays into the longer hitter's hands, doesn't it? Because they can actually get themselves 30 yards closer and thus 2 clubs less.
Who are we thinking is going?
It seems to be there's only one man for it. Bearing in mind, the last winner there was an Aussie. So you need to be long straight. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. That's what I'm thinking. He's sort of friend of the pod.
Favorite of the pod.
He's an Aussie. I'm sure he's been in Jeff's ear. Is Jeff turning up this week as past champion? Can he still knock it around?
He is playing. I've gone a little bit more left field. I'm going to go Patrick Reed for the win.
It's someone who's going to be like that. So why even like a Kisner? Because you think Kisner's
Kisner is every time.
Just try and make this.
If it's not going to be Lucas Michel, who's an amateur golfer and his first ever appearance in a major, it's got to be Kisner. I just can't see anyone else.
I mean, see on the webcam the picture of Kevin Kisner in the background there, and your collage of
that's Kolsarts
paraphernalia.
That's Kolsarts.
Well, yeah, I mean, if Kolsarts was in the field, we know you'd be picking him.
But seriously, I like Schauffele. I think he's got a chance.
X-Man.
While you're talking about Lele's, I fancy Cantalele.
He'd be up there on my list, definitely.
Is he trending though? Is he trending in the right direction?
No, he's not. He's definitely not. Definitely not.
He's in reverse, but anyone could pull it out in the open, can't they?
What about our man Berger, who we've spoken a lot about in previous pods? Is he still shooting in the 60s most rounds?
Yeah, he's doing good, isn't he? I mean,
if he won the US Open, he'd almost have to get an invite to Augusta, wouldn't he? That would just
the competition Jeff committee Hopkins at Augusta would be under a biblical amount of pressure, wouldn't they? Then,
what do we feel like is going to happen to the Incredible Hulk this week?
Could go very well.
I don't know.
Could win it. He's got so much distance.
He came from nowhere at the USPGA to sort of to still, like, people have probably forgotten about him. Not forgotten about him, but he was just hanging around, and then back nine on Sunday, he still had a chance.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see if he just tries to go after it.
I mean, there's one man in the field who's got the opportunity of a career Grand Slam. Philly Mick.
Yeah.
You know, he hasn't played for the last few weeks, but when he did, I think it was his first event on the Champions Tour. Shot like 30 under and won that. It was sort of 5,000-yard course, though, and everything else. So
I'm going to call it. If he wins this, it could almost be one of the greatest wins in golfing history, if not the greatest win.
So I'm thinking...
It could be. It'd be the oldest major winner, I think, in living memory.
He's got it. So I'm gesturing with the mic here. I'm thinking... US Open trophy in one hand, coffee for wellness in the left.
Chewing CBD. He just have those sort of, do you remember those old trousers they used to make for kids with the sort of little cutoffs that you could zip off, and he'd just be wearing those and just zip those off at the prize giving ceremony. Flex the calves.
Exactly.
Coffee in one hand, trophy in the other, as you say, Cal. Yeah.
Oh, so good.
Maybe some velcroed like Chippendale trousers,
and then just go and gamble it all away. That evening.
Put it on red. And then in terms of best of the Brits, just to wrap it up. I mean, Casey went pretty close. USPGA. He drives the ball well. He's straight. If he can get that putter going, who knows?
Yeah.
Tyrrell's got a chance as well.
Yeah. Exactly.
That would be, yeah.
I think
that'd be quite an amusing.
He's fairly color, isn't it? Fairly straight off the tee. Great putter.
I think
they're two good chances, but
I reckon Webb Simpson.
It'll be very, very
two.
You're not fancying Webb, are you?
Well, mate, his swing is obviously awful to look at, but you've got to respect the guy. I mean, he's got incredible hand eye coordination, he's gritty as hell, great short game, and hits it on a rope. So yeah, actually I would back him.
With God on his side, you know, you wouldn't bet against him.
Right. That's about it for us. You've had our tips. I mean, I'm fancy Cantalele. I'm going to put a couple of quid on Cantalele, I reckon. But so thank you for tuning in. If you haven't already, make sure you check out The Story of a Golf Club on YouTube. And make sure you get in touch on Instagram and Twitter, because we do love reading what you guys post in. But until then, see you soon.
Adios.
See you soon.
Watch this.